The New York Police Department has fired a white police officer who used a fatal chokehold during the 2014 arrest of a black man in a case that fueled nationwide protests. Eric Garner's dying words, "I can't breathe," became a rallying cry for the demonstrators and sparked a national debate over race and the use of force by police, helping to ignite the Black Lives Matter movement. New York Police Commissioner James O'Neill told reporters Monday that police officer Daniel Pantaleo has been dismissed from the force over Garner's death. He said the firing was based on a recent recommendation of a department disciplinary judge. I'm Joe Palca, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to African News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on African News Tonight...
There is no doubt that a political solution is necessary for Libya, but the question is when. Will it take place before or after the LNA has taken Tripoli, or maybe right now even more of concern, in time before the whole country of Libya disintegrates?
That's Wolfgang Pushtai, policy and security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, on the prospects of a political solution in Libya. Details coming up also. Zimbabwe's recent clampdown on dissenting voices has worsened, and new protests have broken out in Sudan's capital. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo expressed American concerns over the prolonged conflict in Libya in a phone call Monday with his Egyptian counterpart, Sameh Shoukry, and they agreed on the need for a political solution. UN envoy to Libya, Ghassan Salami, said the regional flow of arms is fueling the conflict. Egypt and the United Arab Emirates are supporting Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, LNA, who has been trying to take Tripoli from forces allied with the internationally recognized government. Meanwhile, Turkey is backing the GNA with drones and technical support. VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi spoke with Wolfgang Pushtai, policy and security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, about U.S. concerns over the continued conflict in Libya.
I would say Pompeo and Shoukry are probably concerned that the current spread of violence to the south, to the Fezzan, could eventually lead to a wildfire encompassing all over Libya. Such an escalation could lead to a disintegration of the LNA, which is of utmost concern for the Egyptians, and to the subsequent outbreak of fighting even in eastern Libya, in the Cyrenaica, maybe even close to the Egyptian border. All this would make it for Islamic extremists and for terrorist organizations like ISIS or Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb even easier to use Libya as a base for the destabilization of the whole region. And this is absolutely a no-go for both, for the Egyptians and for the United States. I would say there is no doubt that a political solution is necessary for Libya, but the question is when. Will it take place before or after the LNA has taken Tripoli, or maybe right now even more of concern, in time before the whole country of Libya disintegrates?
Egypt and the United Arab Emirates are supporting Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, who has been trying to take Tripoli from forces allied with the internationally recognized government GNA, while Turkey is backing the GNA with drones and technical support. Can the United States pressure its allies to stop supporting the two warring sides?
No, certainly not. The United States wasn't even able to prevent Turkey from buying Russian air defense systems, which was all over the media recently, and from attacking American allies, the Kurds, in Syria, even when American troops were on the ground next to the Kurds. So we can certainly forget about Washington preventing Ankara from delivering and operating weapons for the GNA. And on the other side, we need to be aware that Egypt is a key ally for the United States to guarantee the security of Israel. The United Arab Emirates and also Saudi Arabia are instrumental in the conflict with Iran right now. And the United States will certainly not harm its relations with those key partners in order to prevent the GNA and the Islamists in Tripoli from getting defeated.
The United Nations envoy for Libya, Hassan Salami, warned that an influx of weapons from foreign supporters in violation of an arms embargo was fueling the conflict in Libya. How do you explain the lack of action by the United Nations Security Council on the violation of UN embargo on arms to Libya?
There is an UN weapons embargo over Libya since 2011, and there are several UN reports about the violations. But there is simply no one capable and willing to enforce it. The European Union Operation Sophia, the maritime operation off the coast of Libya, has also the mandate to contribute to the implementation of this arms embargo. But the Europeans did not intercept a single ship with arms on the way to Libya, although there were several ships going on during the recent years. Regarding Egypt, it is simply technically not realistic that anyone could be able to stop the flow of weapons and other military supplies over the land border between those two countries. Another option would be certainly to impose sanctions on those violating the arms embargo. But sanctions are neither on the table in the UN Security Council against Turkey and Qatar or against the Saudis, Emirates and Egypt. It is absolutely not realistic that everyone in the Security Council would agree to sanctions to their partners on the ground. And we need to be aware that most times sanctions are not efficient in the short to mid-term. The expected impact of sanctions would not be in any relation to the damage that they would inflict on the bilateral relations with these countries. So we can also forget about sanctions.
That was Wolfgang Poschta, a policy and security analyst at the National Council on U.S.-Libya Relations, speaking with VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawy. The UN Refugee Agency is repeating its appeal to European nations to allow the immediate disembarkation of people stranded aboard the rescue vessel Open Arms as conditions on the ship rapidly deteriorate. Lisa Schlein reports from UNHCR headquarters in Geneva.
In a rare concession, Italy's right-wing interior minister, Matteo Salvini, allowed 27 unaccompanied minors to be evacuated from the vessel in the port of Lampedusa Saturday. A further 9 were allowed to leave Monday evening for urgent medical reasons. But that leaves 98 refugees and migrants trapped on board the Spanish NGO rescue vessel, Open Arms. UN refugee spokesman Andrei Mihecic says conditions have become intolerable on the ship, which has been stranded at sea for 18 days.
For those who are on board, there remain significant humanitarian needs, particularly psychosocial support that is needed, that cannot be met on the vessel itself. Many of the rescued people suffered horrific abuses during many months in Libya.
Mihecic says 6 European Union countries say they are willing to receive the rescued passengers after disembarkation. So this, he says, should be a simple matter of getting the largely African refugee and migrants safely to dry land.
The political debate, in our view, should be focused on what is motivating people to move. The war in Libya, the need for asylum, and saving lives at sea. Rescued people should not be used as hostages for the purpose of political point scoring.
However, Salvini, who considers his anti-immigrant stance a winning political issue, refuses to budge from his position and allow the Open Arms to dock. In the meantime, a similar drama is unfolding aboard the Ocean Viking, a rescue vessel run by the charity Doctors Without Borders. It has been stranded at sea since August 9th, when it rescued 356 people, many from Somalia, Eritrea, and Sudan. Mihecic says it is likely conditions aboard that vessel are similar to those on the Open Arms. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Somalia's regional state of Jubaland will this week elect a new president, but the electoral process has been marred by threats, intimidation, violence, and outside interference. For VOA, Mohamed Yusuf reports.
4 candidates have expressed their interest to lead the Jubaland federal state of Somalia in the next 4 years. The incumbent Ahmed Islam, best known as Madobe, will compete against Anab Dahir, Mohamed Gedi, and Mohamud Omar. The electoral process has been marred by lack of transparency, and critics say the commission is trying to tip the election in Madube's favor. Hamza Bare is the head of the Jubaland Electoral Commission. He says he's happy with the process so far. The electoral process is going on well. We're almost to the end of the process. It was a long journey, Bare says. Now we are in a situation where we have a parliament with its leadership, and today all the candidates spoke to the parliamentarians who seek their vote, and Thursday a president will be elected. However, those opposing Madobe's rule have formed their own electoral commission, and in a statement they said they will elect their own president. The United Nations Political Office in Somalia called on the commission to address the concerns about the election process, only to be contradicted by Kenya's Ministry of Foreign Affairs, which called on the UN office to withdraw their statement. Kenya has a strong presence in the port city of Kismayo, the largest city in Jubaland. George Musamali, director of the Center for Risk Management in Africa, says militant group Al-Shabaab will try to exploit the political divisions.
Definitely now Al-Shabaab will take advantage of this, and the Somali national government will also focus on fighting and defeating Jubaland. You will find that this will also prove shaky for the Kenyan presence in Somali. And basically, it's also going to expose Kenya to more threats from the Al-Shabaab, bearing in mind now that they'll be on the conflicting side with the Somali national government.
Horn of Africa political commentator Abdulhab Sheikh Abdi Samad says the political rift could push some communities to join Al-Shabaab. The clan division within Jubaland is going to benefit Islamist groups and make them strong, Abdi Samad says. They will be able to get people who are not happy with what is happening there and to get revenge using such groups. Somalia has a history of rivalries and unstable governments dating back to the country's independence in 1960. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
New protests have broken out in Sudan's capital, but this time outside the Sudanese Professionals Association, SPA, a labor union which played a central role in negotiating a power-sharing deal between the military and the opposition. Some opposition members say they are unhappy with a lack of transparency from the SPA. In Khartoum, VOA's Isha Sarai has more.
The Sudanese Professionals Association, or SPA, was one of the leading voices in the Forces of Freedom and Change Coalition, the opposition group that negotiated terms for a transitional government with military leaders who seized power in April. But after the formal signing of the agreement last weekend, small protests from opposition supporters have continued outside SPA headquarters. One of the protesters, Nahid Bustami, says she doesn't feel the SPA has been transparent about its negotiations for the political agreement. Bustami says that when the revolution began, the SPA was very clear in their communications with supporters about what was happening. But she says that since the negotiations started, she doesn't think the SPA is clearly communicating what is going on. Bustami and other protesters like Ghazi Al-Raya say they feel that the SPA has strayed from their mission to be a politically neutral labor union.
We are demanding that they pay attention and work on their main mission, which was working on making strong unions and civil services.
Additionally, many protesters have been pushing the SPA to fight for the punishment of military leaders presumed responsible for the killing of over 100 protesters in June, as well as tracking down a dozen protesters who remain missing. But Naji Al-Assam, a member of SPA's secretariat who has become the young public face of the organization, says protesters are conflating the SPA's responsibilities with those of the new government.
They are dealing with SPA as if it is the new government in Sudan. This is not true. SPA will remain as an independent body. It's true that it has very good links with, and it will have very good links with the new government, but it will never be the government.
Still, an SPA spokesman and member of Sudan's doctor syndicate, Amjad Farid, says that the union welcomes the protests.
We have several protests in front of the headquarters of the Sudanese Professional Association, and we don't think this is a bad thing. The Sudanese people are practicing their rights to make the political entities and the entities that are engaged in the political process accountable to their demands.
And to make good on his encouragement of the protests, Farid and other members of the SPA often answer them by meeting demonstrators directly, taking questions from them and making note of their demands. Isha Sarai, VOA News, Khartoum.
19 past the hour, you're listening to Africa News Tonight on The Voice of America. Women, peace and security are on the agenda at the military conference in Ghana this week, where experts say deploying women into peacekeeping forces will make missions more effective and make civilian women feel safer in reporting abuses. Stacey Knott reports from Accra.
Vida Nyakanga, a warrant officer in Ghana's military, has been deployed for peacekeeping missions across Africa and in Lebanon. Being a woman, she says, gives her certain access to people and information her male counterparts might not have. Women felt more comfortable speaking to other women, she found, especially when they took part in their daily activities.
When we see the women, the local women cooking, we try to join them, do their cooking in their farms. We go to help them. This is a medical outreach. We try to interact with them. And you see them coming closer. Through that, we get vital information from them.
Ghana is well known for its contributions to peacekeeping forces and deploys large numbers of women in a field that generally has few. Currently, women make up 4.9% of global peacekeepers, but the United Nations has a target of 15% by 2028. At the first day of the Africa Endeavour 2019 conference, female military personnel from across the world gathered to discuss the roles men and women play in peacekeeping operations. Studies show more female peacekeepers increases mission effectiveness and leads to a higher reporting of sexual and gender-based violence, as well as lower levels of sexual exploitation and abuse. Ghana Armed Forces Brigadier General Constance Ijani Afenu can attest to this.
Women have specific roles to play in areas, conflict areas where we have had cases of rape, sexual violence and stuff like that. We have women who, when they go on patrols, reach out to these women and they open up and they are able to talk and they get help where they are supposed to get help.
In recent years, there have been widespread allegations of peacekeepers sexually abusing civilians while stationed in African conflict zones. The United Nations has launched a project on improving peacekeepers' performance and behaviour, with a strong emphasis on leadership and accountability. Stacey Knott for VOA News, Accra.
Zimbabwe's deteriorating economy is forcing many families to put their children to work. Child rights activists say an increasing number of children are selling items on the street to supplement the family income. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
On a busy corner, a 16-year-old we shall call Tribunal sells wares. Tribunal says this has been her story for the past 2 years after her mother died and she dropped out of school. She now lives with her 22-year-old sister. Tribunal says she gets about $5 a day in sales. Tribunal says she actually wishes for a decent life and does not want to sell stuff here. But she felt that she could not force her father to pay her school fees as he is no longer employed. Tribunal says her father is even failing to pay fees for her 12-year-old brother, which she's now doing. She says she hopes her brother makes it in life. On Thursday, Health and Child Welfare Minister Obadiah Moyo said President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government was aware of the plight of Tribunal and other children. He said Harare was working with organizations like UNICEF and other rights groups to remedy the situation. Ratzai Moyo, a program manager at children's rights group, Childline Zimbabwe, says her organization has noted an increase in the number of youngsters being forced into working to survive as the economic situation deteriorates.
But now with the economic challenge, you can imagine in one community where a child has to go and sell maputi, for instance, and they don't bring back any income because nobody bought from them. Then the parent will then reward those who sold with food, and the one who didn't sell, because you didn't bring any money home, so how do you expect to eat? So we're now engaging with parents that you shouldn't punish children by withdrawing food. Yes, things are hard, and it will also be hard for them to sell if it was what they do after school. So they won't be able to sell anything.
The economic turmoil is blamed for a rise in political tensions in the African nation. Anti-government protests are scheduled for Friday. The government has threatened to stop the demonstrations. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare.
Growing up with albinism, 24-year-old Alan Herbert, a Kenyan journalism graduate, knew he was different. While he did not experience the same stigmatism and discrimination of his peers living with albinism, he had to be shielded from the sun. It is this special treatment and media stories of the brutal attacks suffered against albinos that made Herbert start a football team, his way of helping people with the genetic disorder fight for their space in Kenya. This past weekend, the team won its debut match in what Herbert says he hopes is a first of many. Sarah Kimani has the story.
On a cloudy Saturday morning, 24-year-old Alan Herbert, founder and team captain of Black Albinism Football Club, Kenya's first football team made up entirely of young people living with albinism, prepares for a football match with his team. In a country where people living with albinism are still stigmatized, this is no ordinary team or match.
Football brings people of different diversities together, and when we decided a sport, we said football is the easiest, and actually it's also in the Kenyan curriculum, so people relate with football a little bit easier.
Across East Africa, people with albinism have been targeted in brutal ritual killings for their body parts to be used in witchcraft, mainly due to their white skin, a condition that is caused by lack of pigmentation. Isaac Maura, a senator in Kenya, has been campaigning for the rights of people with albinism. He is Kenya's first and only lawmaker living with albinism.
Because people with albinism really suffer. They are black but not black enough, white but not white enough, disabled but not disabled enough. So we are caught in between it. And when we're caught in between it, we don't quite belong. So we have to self-define. These are self-definition activities.
In their debut match, the six-month-old team carries the day 4-2 in a penalty shootout.
Once we fight the discrimination, once we beat off the stigmatization, then you can see the greatness that is in us. You have realized here how we've won. Yeah, we've won fair and square.
As the match comes to an end and Herbert celebrates with his teammates, the journalism graduate says there is no turning back on the dream of one day playing in the Kenyan Premier League and hopefully representing his country on the international stage.
We are not different in any way. The only thing that we have, that our skin is a little bit pale and we have issues with our eyesight, but that does not make us less of people.
For now, it's time to revel in the first win. Sarah Kimani for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports. Tune in again at 1800 UTC for another edition of Africa News Tonight. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Tomas Blondet, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa,
Historically black colleges and universities in the United States have also educated prominent Africans, like the founding presidents of Nigeria, Ghana, and Malawi. The role of historically black colleges and universities on the continent on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
The Voice of America's flagship global news program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than